Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of October. This week, we are very pleased to have Dr. Fred Sharp of the Alaska Whale Foundation joining us again, speaking with us via telephone on some cool new techniques in wildlife research. I'm also happy to have our faithful sound engineer, Charlie Fleischman, helping me share observations and events today. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, Debron.
Before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. This is currently an uncommon sound in our area, but it's one that you'll likely be hearing a lot more of in future. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is.
It's been getting noticeably colder out there, with hikers surprised by fresh snow up at Marmot Pass this past week. More snow is predicted for the Olympic Mountains this week, with the snow level forecast to drop down to 5,500 feet on Wednesday and hovering around 6,500 feet through the weekend.
But down here at lower elevations, I've been amazed by the prolific berry crop on the Madrona trees this year. When looking at the trees at first, I thought that what I was seeing were dying leaves, but on closer inspection, I found that they were dense clusters of orange berries instead. But now I'm left to wonder if this is a sacrificial fruiting phenomenon, as we know happens with conifer trees when they put most of their energy into cone production when under drought stress, or if the trees are producing so many berries because they're thriving with the current dry conditions. So if you know the answer to this, please drop us a line at naturenow@kptz.org. What we do know is that there are many species of birds that are very happy about the abundant berries, most notably cedar waxwings and American robins. And today, I even saw a northern flicker, which is a woodpecker, and I normally think of it as an anteater, but it was munching berries.
Jeff Hammerson sent us another wonderful photo essay on the latest natural history current events, including a beautiful photo of a spotted tussock moth caterpillar. These caterpillars are covered with lovely golden bristles, with black spots along their spine and longer white bristles sticking out front and aft. But don't be tempted to pick them up with bare hands, as some people are highly allergic to those beautiful hairs. They are currently roaming about on the ground, looking for suitable places to build their cocoons. Dozens of woolly bear caterpillars, which have the dramatic orange and black stripes, were also seen crossing the roads, on their way to potential hibernation sites.
Jeff also sent along a photo of a juvenile creeping vole, which I don't think that I've ever seen before. They look rather like a miniature mountain beaver, with tiny eyes and ears and a short tail, and are about 4.5 inches long, without the tail. These voles are common in our area, but rarely seen, as they are mostly active at night, burrowing about 1 inch under the ground, which generally protects them from aerial predators. They use various habitats, eat plants and fungi, and breed prolifically. An adult female may produce 4 to 5 litters of several young each year.
Northwest garter snakes are still active, often basking in the sun on a clear day, perhaps digesting a recent meal of snails or slugs, which had helped you clear from your garden.
We apologize in advance for an interview that might be a bit ragged around the edges. Communication with Fred Sharp up in Alaska has only been sporadically available for the last couple of weeks, and we're hoping that we can get through to him on a phone call today and that it's actually audible on air. So, Fred, we're so happy to reach you by phone, and you're up on Baranoff Island.
Darn tootin'.
You're starting up a new research station with some colleagues of yours, right?
That is correct. We're here on the lovely eastern shore of Baranoff Island in the Panhandle in southeast Alaska. Yeah, we have this wonderful opportunity here for a field station. We're calling it the Center for Coastal Conservation. And we are sit amidst mountains and beautiful rivers, gigantic waterfalls, ancient forests, and oh, did I mention we're blessed with numerous hot pools of water that come bubbling up out of the earth.
But the main focus of your research for the past couple of years or couple of decades has been on humpback whales in southeast Alaska, right?
That's correct. And the SILT station here provides a unique opportunity to access these animals. For many years, we studied them at sea with our research vessel Evolution. Now we've been able to establish a beachhead in this beautiful little community of Baranof Warm Springs. The center is interested in a variety of relevant conservation questions, including vegetation analysis, bird analysis, inquiry associated with our changing climate, health of ecosystems. Of course, we still have a strong marine component with the humpback whales. We've also been doing surveys looking at sea otter populations, increasing humpback whale populations. We also have sperm whales in the area, and a lot of things we're looking at are of interest in that they're associated now with many of the species of marine mammals are recovering so well. We're seeing them shift out from being threatened or endangered, actually becoming so ubiquitous that now they're starting to consume a fair amount of biomass, which is putting them in direct competition with human fisheries. So that's an interesting
That's
aspect.
Right. You were telling me that some of the humpbacks have learned to position themselves near the hatcheries and scoop up a bunch of juvenile salmon.
I guess like any good predator will, and when you put out these huge amounts of small salmon, fingerlings fry by the tens of millions into the water, that's naturally going to attract a recovering predator population. And we've had the good fortune to collaborate with the Sitka Sound Science Center and the University of Alaska Southeast and several fisher organizations on this tantalizing question of what we call depredation, and with the long-term goal of making sure that everybody get what they need. There's enough for everybody to go around.
So are you seeing many whales up there right now, or have most of them headed to Hawaii for the breeding season?
In fact, looking out the window right now, we're seeing a couple of humpback whales a few miles away off at the mouth of Warm Springs Bay and the beautiful confluence of Chatham Strait. Lovely mirror pond, smooth waters out there today, and occasionally we can see a whale leaping up and breaching and playing and peck slapping, and there's still lots of whales around here, actually. Population has been increasing dramatically over the past several decades with the cessation of harvesting and whaling on these species, and it's just really made great to be in this part of the world here in southeast Alaska. There used to be lots of people around here back in the day. There was a lot more canneries, salteries. There's a whaling station just around the corner, log camps, gypsum mining, box farms, and that's all pretty much gone away. And just about every bay you go into, there's these beautiful old ruins going back into the forest and beaches and waters whence they came. And it's just us now and the magnificent whales, otters, pinnipeds, seabirds, and our fellow ecologists.
So there were reports of numerous humpback whales sighted in the Straits of Juan de Fuca and up in the San Juans last week. Would any of these be southeast Alaska whales that have moved south?
Pretty unlikely that the whales, that the wonderful resurging, recovering whales that we see in the Straits of Juan de Fuca are the same whales that come here to southeast Alaska. Most of the whales that we have up here, sort of north of the Straits of Juan de Fuca, many of those whales travel to Polynesia and Hawaii as their predominant breeding area. Whereas the whales that you get off of southern D.C., Washington, Oregon, and California, many of them have Mexican, coastal Mexican, or even Central American affinities. And that's a wonderful thing about these long-lived, highly migratory, intelligent beings, is that the mothers and the calves on their first year being born in the subtropics, the calf will follow its mom to up to the breeding areas and develop a lot of sight fidelity, learn how to feed in this high, along the high North Pacific Rim are cool, tempered, highly conductive waters. Then in the fall, about this time of the year, the animals are getting ready to head south. The calf will follow its mom back down to its breeding area. And that's what we call both strong natal phylopatry, meaning love of birth, the place of your birth, and then sight fidelity on the feeding ground. And so once the animals pick a certain feeding and breeding area, even though it may be 4,000 or 5,000 miles apart, they will go on that same migration, just like a good commuter, for the rest of their lives. So we don't think there's a lot of mixing between the Californian and Mexican whales along the Washington coast and the Polynesian whales up here to the north.
Huh. Well, you've summarized it nicely. But just about 6 weeks ago, you were involved with a really amazing study testing some new cutting-edge research techniques. And you were working with folks from the Ocean Alliance?
Yes, I had the very good fortune to work with Ian Kerr and Dr. Roger Payne and Andy Brogan and several of their colleagues. They are with the Ocean Alliance out of Gloucester, Massachusetts, and they have a lovely program. They're looking primarily at the ecotoxicology of marine mammals, and I had the good fortune just to start collaborating with them, over 20 years ago now. And in fact, Roger Payne and Ian Kerr were sort of the impetus of us to start our own nonprofit, whale research nonprofit, the Alaska Whale Foundation.
Oh, I didn't realize that your alliance with them went so far back.
Yeah, it's been a lovely, enduring journey. Dr. Roger Payne was on my graduate committee, and we still got a couple of collaborative papers that we're working on, looking at the diversity and change of non-song calls through time. So it's a really wonderful collaboration. Yeah, it's great to have them back up here and after all these years, and they brought with them some remarkable tools. Those include the ability to sample animals without a necropsy, without having to cause any outwardly harm or any type of invasive techniques to be able to gain insight into the health of these beings. And you know, just like in the same way when you go to your doctor, they'll take your temperature and they may take a cheek swab and they may take some samples of urine or your blood to analyze this, look at your health. And it's the same thing with these whales. And what Ian Kerr and his team have come up with is utilizing drones or quad choppers, or what we call aerial unmanned vehicles. And they've become so popular now. And these can be incredible tools when it comes to minimally invasively sampling the blow, the spouts of these animals when they come up to the surface.
It's a brilliant idea. So how did they come up with that idea? They use a Petri dish on the underside of the drone, right?
That is correct. Petri dishes are used. Very simple. We just try to use as much as a sterile technique as we can, and we'll put three Petri dishes actually on the top of the drone, right between the rotor blades. And then when we see a whale that looks like a likely candidate, one that we can not only get a sample from, but one we can also get a fluke ID. We'd like to know who it is, of course. We'll fly over towards the animal.
Because the drones have a really good camera on them, too, right?
They do. We have multiple cameras on them and cameras with polarizing filters on so we can see down into the water. We can see the whale coming up. And the idea is to position yourself over the whale in a manner that tries to reduce any fright reaction or fear in the animal. And in many ways, it's much better than trying to get close with a boat and use a long Kevlar pole with a Petri dish on the end.
How far away can you be? You guys are on the boat, right? And there's a pilot that's flying the drone. And how far away can the drone be from where you are?
Oh, the drone can be up to a couple hundred yards. The pilot has what's called first-person view, and he can look into almost like 3D goggles. You can look into a screen and control, and there's a camera on the quad chopper, so the quad chopper can be several hundred yards away, but he's seeing all the action as if he was flying right above the whale. We were operating under a commercial 333 federal aviation permit that required that we had to have a trained licensed pilot with us who would basically control ground operations and make recommendations when we could fly, how fast and how far and under what conditions, and warning other airplanes or grounding us if there was too much fog. It turned out we had beautiful days of sunny weather, and we were able to successfully obtain over 40 spout samples from 40 different whales.
So what kind of information do you gather from those spout samples?
Well, the big question is, how healthy are humpback whales and how healthy are marine mammals in general? You want to be able to get, you know, just standard baseline. And along the North Pacific coast here, we seem to have one of the healthiest populations of humpback whales in the world and largely pristine waters that they feed in. Other studies have shown that they have relatively low contaminant burdens relative to other populations. Reproductively, they are showing a strong recovery. Every reason to believe that this is a pretty healthy population, plenty to eat. And so it makes a great baseline for comparing other beleaguered world populations. For example, there's one in the Arabian Sea that's very small and depleted. Also, the Canary Islands, humpback whale populations in the western Pacific around Japan, they have also been subjected to intensive and enduring exploitation. So there are some small groups that we're really concerned about. And so samples from both populations, just to check on their general health indices, see if we can gain some insight into why they're not recovering as fast. Is it because they were just cropped down so low it takes a long time to get back to that phase when you can start to grow pretty quickly with your numbers? Or is there something about the activities or stressors or food relations or something about human activity in these areas that are preventing the animals from recovering? And so we take a lot of diagnostic measures. One of them is just your simple stress hormone. In the spout of a whale, you can actually look for cortisol, which is a stressor hormone that is released when the animal is frightened or has impaired function, impaired immune response. We can also check for reproductive hormones to see if the female is ovulating or is carrying a calf. So that can give us also insight into reproductive parameters.
That's amazing that you can find that out from just the spout sample.
It truly is. Also, we're collaborating with Scott Baker's lab at Oregon State University, down at the Newport Marine Labs, and he is looking at the genetics. We can actually get, when epithelial cells inside the blowhole slough off, those also become airborne and can produce high-quality DNA. And we can start to look at how closely animals within a local population are related to other. And we can also look for the bigger questions as to, are these animals coming from, say, Panama, Mexico, Hawaii, or even have a few Japanese whales that are making the trip all the way over to Southeast Alaska, just simply based on their genetic signature.
So do you think that this will be able to replace the use of the more invasive sampling techniques? And explain a bit about what you used to do. You used to dart and get a little bit of a flesh sample, right?
Yes, that is correct. I think it actually can show a lot of promise. Still looking at the assays, and we're still trying to get appreciation of how the quality and abundance of these diagnostic compounds and hormones and genetic features are out of the animal. It very possibly will become a very widely used technique in the future. I mean, sometimes you just need to get larger samples. If you're doing contamination in fatty tissues or if you're doing isotopic analysis, you sometimes need a little bit larger samples, which may be more appropriately taken using a biopsy dart. I know there's been recently a very unfortunate case where a killer whale mortality was associated with a radio satellite tag that was in the dorsal fin, and there was complications associated with that. And there was a situation where either through lack of appropriate procedures and sterilizing the subdermally anchored tag that it caused, one of causing an infection, which of course is a very tragic outcome.
I remember reading about that and thought about this, how your new sampling technique will prevent that happening in future, which is a great thing.
I think it can certainly help in sensing animals and also looking for potential heavy metals or other contaminants in the spout. The biofaunas, the microbiome in the lungs can tell us, give us insight into their potential health. I'm actually doing so incredibly well here in not only the North Pacific, but pretty much the entire world. Most of the humpback whales, you may have heard just in the past month, was delisted from the Endangered Species Act, and fantastic, put our hands together.
It is. That's amazingly, that's great news.
They were one of the original signatories on the Endangered Species Act that was signed into law by Richard Nixon. So after these more than a quarter century, I guess pushing a half century, to be able to say that, hey, this animal they're finding enough to eat, and they're finding clean water and places where they can raise their calves and migrate and relatively peace and come roaring back in 10 of the 14 global populations, what we call them distinct population segments. 10 of those have been delisted, and that's just super exciting.
Hey, I'm so sorry, but we are out of time for you today. And thanks so much for sharing this cool new research information and the good news about the whales. Please send our best to those whales and other creatures up north, and you be safe up there.
You bet. Thanks a lot, Deborah. And I'm so glad to hear that there's whales are recovering to the waters of the Salish Sea. Let there be celebrations up and down our coast.
Hear, hear. We have lots of cool upcoming natural history events to tell you about. First, come to a public hearing at the Quilcene High School starting at 6 p.m. on Thursday, October 13th to learn more about expanding the Debab Bay and Devil's Lake Natural Resource Conservation Areas. Go to safeland.org for a link to the DNR site for more information.
On Friday, October 14th, join the Jefferson Land Trust and Western Wildlife Outreach for an evening learning about the endangered mountain caribou of the Pacific Northwest. Come to the Cotton Building in downtown Port Townsend at 7 p.m. Go to saveland.org for more details.
Then on Saturday, October 15th, the Geology Group hosts a lecture on geologic nozzles, Mount St. Helens to Yellowstone. Come to the Quimper Unitarian Fellowship at 4 p.m. or go to quimpergeology.org for more information.
Lastly, the Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society begins its fall lecture series next Tuesday, October 18th, with a presentation from Far Reaches Farm Nursery on botanizing in China. Come to the Port Townsend Community Center. Social time starts at 6:30 with lecture at 7 p.m.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a Western or California scrub jay, a sound that you will doubtless be hearing more of in the coming years on the Olympic Peninsula. Our local Audubon chapter has recorded sightings in our area for the past couple of weeks, and they are also being seen with increased frequency over in Seattle. California scrub jays have been expanding their range northward and eastward since the 1970s. The expansion is most likely due to increased residential development and feeding by humans, and will probably continue, especially given how clever and opportunistic these members of the corvid family are. Their relative, the Steller's jay, has always been resident in our area, but the scrub jay is distinguished from these by its lack of a black crest and a pale chest and underbelly, lined with a partial blue band. The call is also different if you listen carefully. The Steller's jay normally gives a harsh shark, shark sound, while the California gives a higher pitched, rising shink, more of a shink sound. The name for the species was just changed this year when the Western scrub jay was split into two different species. The Pacific Coast species that we get here now is called the California scrub jay. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the second week of October. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always,
happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is White Rabbit, performed by Dr. Drone.
Don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. And if you go.